Hello, I'm Matt Baume, and welcome to The Sewers of Paris. We're on a podcast search for the entertainment that changed the lives of queer people. On tonight's episode, Fandom Acts of Kindness. We're doing something a little different on this week's episode. We've got two guests. Kayla Joseph and Tanya Cook are the authors of the new book, Fandom Acts of Kindness, which is about how fandoms can change the world, from Star Trek to Xena Warrior Princess to Supernatural and Our Flag Means Death and beyond. Kayla and Tanya have spent years within various nerdy communities, and they've seen how fans can use their love of all things geeky to make the world a better place. We'll have that conversation in a minute. First, a reminder that I've got a book coming out next year about queer sitcoms. It's called Hi Honey, I'm Homo, and pre-orders are now open. Head over to gaysitcoms.com to get all the details. And a big thanks to everybody who supports The Sewers of Paris on Patreon. Head over to sewersofparis.com to support the show and listen to over 400 past episodes. Now, here's my conversation with Kayla and Tanya. Well, this week I'm speaking with Kayla, a psychologist, and Tanya, a sociology professor. Both are the authors of Fandom Acts of Kindness. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
So usually I have guests talk about the entertainment that changed their life, and we'll get to that. But first, I just want to have you introduce yourselves a little bit and tell me about your book.
Sure. This is Tanya. I'll go first. My name is Tanya Cook. I am a sociology professor. I teach at the Community College of Aurora, which is near Denver, Colorado. And let's see, our book is the culmination of many, many years of being fascinated with fandom and fan culture, and especially the charitable actions that we've seen fans do that we think are really a lot like a social movement. So that's how we came to write the book. And the book is meant to answer the question that we got asked a lot at conventions, which was, well, all this about fan charity work and fan activism is great, but how do I do it? You know, what is the actual way I get involved? So this book is an answer to that question.
Got it. And Kayla, tell us a little about you.
Yeah. So I'm Kayla. I'm, as you mentioned, a psychologist. And I actually found Tanya through fandom before this book was a full concept. Tanya was doing some work on fandom and charity and looking at the ways that fandom was like religion. And one of the actors of the show Supernatural, Misha Collins, actually tweeted about the work that Tanya was doing. It had gotten to him somehow that Tanya was presenting at a sociology conference, and he sort of tweeted this as a joke. And I saw it and went, oh, this is exactly the kind of research I want to be involved in, and reached out. And then we embarked on this. I think it ended up being a 6-year project.
That sounds right.
Wow. So let's talk about some of the lessons that you learned in that time.
Oh, yeah. This is Tanya. That's just such a great question. So I would say I'll speak for myself, but I'm going to put Kayla in this one too. We want to say thanks to all the fans who shared their time with us and their stories and inspired us. And what we've learned is that fans are intelligent, engaged, passionate, just beyond impressive with what they're able to accomplish and how they're all the myriad ways they're using their time and talents to try to make the world a better place. For me, it just looking at the inspiration of seeing fans come up with creative ways to not only advocate for more representation and better representation in their media, but also in the real world, look at how do I speak up for those who are marginalized? How do I kind of help call attention to issues in a way that is fun and sustainable. So that those are, you know, really lessons we've learned from fans is always being kind in your activism as well, I would say. And I can think of specific examples, but I will let Kayla weigh in too on this question.
Yeah, this is Kayla. I think one of the other things that we saw is that it really spanned kind of all types and all levels of activism as well. So not only was it fun, not only was it sustainable, but there were these very tangible real world changes that people were enacting. And it was everything from an individual act that somebody could do in their home by themselves to things that took many, many thousands of people to pull off.
And I want to hear more about the activism that folks have done. But first, I just want to ask you both if there are fandoms that you yourselves are part of or have enjoyed being a part of in the past.
Yes, this is Tanya. I am part of the Xena Warrior Princess fandom, or Xenites.
Wonderful.
Yes, I was listening to your show and was hoping that would resonate with folks. And I am also part of the Supernatural fandom for the TV show Supernatural. And I go way back. Like, I would say Star Wars was probably my first fandom, and I'm less involved with that community as an adult, but still certainly find inspiration in the media. And then I would say the other fandom community I'm most active in at the moment would be Our Flag Means Death, the HBO Max show that came out earlier this year. And Marvel. I have to say Marvel because I'm a big Captain America and Avengers fan.
And this is Kayla. So a lot of overlap in fandoms. I didn't really get into Xena growing up, but definitely Star Wars was also one of my first fandoms. I think Tanya and I had figured out that we had both played as kids with other folks kind of enacting Star Wars scenes and things like that, which was something we didn't know we shared until very recently. And then the Supernatural fandom, specifically within the Supernatural fandom, I probably participate most in shipping culture within that fandom and the Destiel ship. And then Our Flag Means Death more recently as well.
Are there, I'm hearing a lot of common threads and among them the, I guess, nerdiness of some of those interests. Are there qualities that make a piece of entertainment particularly fandom compatible?
Great question. This is Tanya. And we've talked about this and I've talked about this with fans because we fans really think about this, but I would say there's a lot of themes that are very common. And typically there's a theme of found family, right? Or this group of folks who maybe did not know each other and somehow became close and chose to consider each other like family. And we can see that in something like Star Trek, right? Star Wars or Firefly, right? Or even shows like Wynonna Earp, which I'm also a big fan of, where sometimes the people you may be related to biologically, but other folks become brought into this community. And then it's always kind of these relationships and these characters against the world or against some sort of greater threat. So watching individuals come together in these groups and then organize themselves to try to save the world, sometimes literally. Buffy maybe is another one that you see groups like that coming together. I think that's a real thread in a lot of these media.
Yeah, I can see why that might be particularly inviting for queer audiences.
Yes, I spoke about that in an article I wrote about Wynonna Earp, that that's a real, you know, if you've had to face alienation from your family of origin because of your identity, right, or face rejection, then those folks who you form those intimate relationships with become really important. Right. And so I think recognizing that in pop culture and seeing that exemplified is really important to folks.
How do you define fandom? And is it distinct from being just liking something on your own, or is it a subset of that?
This is Kayla. I can take that one. You can have a fandom around any special interest. So we focus on media fandom, but there's sports fandom and music fandom. Fandom can really be any special interest, anything that folks are a fan of. The thing that makes it a fandom and not just something that you're into, though, is this way of finding community around it, having identity built around it, and what we call participatory culture. So you are actively participating either in critiquing the media or making art or fan fiction. There's lots of different ways to participate. Going to conventions would be another example, but it's really that participatory community aspect that makes it a fandom.
What are the ways that you both participated in your fandoms?
This is Tanya. Growing up, I did not know fan fiction existed, or I would have been writing it, right? As a kid, I think I wrote fan fiction and didn't really understand that's what it would have been. I loved things like Masters of the Universe, He-Man, She-Ra, right? Voltron, you know, various cartoons and things like that, Star Wars, Willow, anything Lucasfilm, Indiana Jones. And I made up my own stories or my own endings to these things. So I would say like my involvement kind of goes back to that. But more recently, I like to cosplay. That's been really important for me personally. I think as an adult, I don't just consume the media. I get thinking about it. I want to write about it. I want to say something bigger about what this is about, and I can understand that more from this perspective. Yes. And then I guess I would say I consume fan art. I don't create it myself, but I enjoy it quite a bit.
This is Kayla. I didn't really fully participate in fandom until I was in grad school. I was sort of nearing the end of grad school when I found the Supernatural fandom. And I had always been really obsessed with the things that I would become obsessed with. So, you know, Buffy fandom was a good example of that. Star Wars fandom was a good example of that. I would consume a lot of things, but not necessarily participate because I didn't know about conventions. And I didn't really know that there were things to participate in until I started watching Supernatural and started finding out about those conventions. I happened to know somebody in grad school who was also going to those conventions. And that's what really opened up the world of what it meant to participate. And then how I participate, one of the big ways that actually was a big inspiration for the book and something that Tanya and I also really connected on was something called the Greatest International Scavenger Hunt, which is this big world record breaking international scavenger hunt that ran for years based out of the charity Random Acts that was started by one of the actors on Supernatural. And that is this opportunity to not just participate in a scavenger hunt, but to do things that you wouldn't normally even imagine that you could do. There's often tasks that felt impossible, like launch something into space was one of the tasks one year. Mm-hmm. And so having these things that you were doing that were for charity, that were for the greater good, and also just getting to have an amazingly fun time and really challenge and push yourself was a big way that I think Tanya and I have both participated in fandom.
This may seem like kind of an obvious question, but I'm curious what your response is to it. What do you get out of participating? Like what keeps you there?
Yeah, that's a great question. This is Tanya. I think the community that you build, you know, we spoke a bit about why and how this happens, and I kind of call it the four C's, right, of fandom, engagement, and activism, like community, collective identity, collective action, and gathering together in communal spaces. Collective effervescence is another term from sociology where it's essentially shared feels. Like it explains why we like going to live events, even if we arguably have a better vantage point to watch a music concert or a sports, you know, event on TV at home in the comfort of our own home with our own snacks that are cheaper. We go in person because we want to feel that being in a crowd experience. And I think that attracts folks to fandom. And then they build those shared relationships with one another. And at least that's what keeps me involved. Like right now in my adult life, many of my closest friends or interactions that I have are in some way traced back to fandom. So it's really a lot of my social life at this point, and outside of work and my personal family, those are the most engagement points I have or connections to society as a whole. So I think that keeps folks coming back, and the, you know, the positive feelings you get from trying to accomplish weird, fun things together.
This is Kayla. I love the word that you used earlier, Tanya, found family. For me, it really is that. I'm somebody who, despite studying LGBTQ psychology and being in queer community in many different ways throughout most of my adulthood, never really quite felt like I totally fit anywhere until I started finding fandom. And that was a community where not only were those collective feels there, but those collective feels were feels that were like, oh, this is where I belong. This is where I can have found family.
I'm so glad that we're talking about found family because it's something that comes up so much on this show. And also, I loved, Tanya, the term that you used, I think it was Tanya, collective effervescence,
which yes. really,
that sums up such a nice feeling that, you know, certainly something that is familiar to me. And I'm curious, like, are there experiences that you each have had, moments that stick in your mind or experiences that are memorable when looking back on it, a time that you've experienced that feeling?
For sure. And just, this is Tanya, just to credit my source, that term comes from Emile Durkheim, one of the founding fathers of sociology. So just, I cannot take ultimate credit for that, of course, as an academic. But I feel that when I go to Comic-Con, and notably at Denver Comic-Con, which is now called something else, but when Supernatural was still airing, we kept putting these Supernatural panels on that were just fan-run panels, right? And we would fill rooms of 800 or 1,000 people. We didn't have any of the actors from the show or any of the creators. It was just fans talking about the show and being able to get up and be somewhat performative and all of us together, you know, singing along to songs from the show or telling jokes or making references and everyone laughing and enjoying that. That's really that experience for me. That was a highlight for sure.
This is Kayla. For me, it was also very much conventions, and the team that I ended up with, the first team that I ended up with in the scavenger hunt that I mentioned earlier, you get paired with people that you don't know if you don't fully form a team of 15. And so the people that we got paired with by chance happened to be a lot of folks who themselves identified as queer and as fans, and seeing just how many shared experiences we had, that we had a shared sense of humor, that we just, you know, immediately gelled and did this amazing week-long no sleep project together. I hadn't really experienced anything like that before, just connecting right away with people.
Can you tell me a little about your research process or exploration process, or you know, the basically how you wrote this book? Like, what went into the 6 years, I think you said, it took to write it?
Yeah, this is Tanya. So 6 years writing is a bit of a miss. I would say the writing part is just one stage. So I was asked some really interesting questions by a friend of mine about Supernatural fandom, maybe in 2015. I started thinking about it and I thought, huh, this really seems like a social movement. And it reminds me a lot, the collective effervescence, those concepts remind me of some of the early forms, early studies of sociological understandings of religion and community and society and essentially where groups come from, if you will. And so from there, I submitted to this conference, presented, as Kayla was saying, that got shared out to millions of people. And that was so strange to me because as an academic, we're not used to our work getting that kind of attention, especially so early in the stages of research. But to back up and more fully answer your question, so we did interviews with fans, dozens of interviews, I would say in-depth ethnographic style interviews. And then we attended a lot of conventions and fandom related events, specifically where this activism or charity work kind of stuff was happening. Everything from, I attended the Granger Leadership Academy, which is they used to be called the Harry Potter Alliance. They are now called Fandom Forward for reasons that we can talk about. And various events like that all around the country, went to conventions, spoke to people. So a lot of that kind of knowledge that you need to really be involved and be doing it to understand that. So we did a lot of that. Then we did, data analysis for a period of years, probably. And from there, kind of put together, all right, what is this book going to look like? And really, there are many books we could have written, but this one is really trying to honor the fans and also become a resource for people who want to get involved in this. It's very accessible. It is not academic, despite me throwing terms out like collective effervescence, right? And citations. So that was the goal, to make it approachable, accessible, useful, and to honor all the amazing work we saw fans do. So a lot of ethnographic work, grounded theory coding is the specific methodology that I've been trained in. And then quite a bit of back and forth with Kayla, honestly, like talking things through, co-writing or taking first drafts and then chiming in on each other's work, things like that, that collaboration.
This is Kayla. I think the other thing that's really important that went into this is that, you know, Tanya and I are both social scientists, but social scientists from sort of different camps. So sociology tends to look at groups, psychology tends to look at individuals. And it was really nice to have this partnership where we could look at both of those things. And so, you know, we talk about things like collective effervescence in the book, but we also talk about self-care, and that's really grounded in things like the interviews that we saw and what people were doing to engage in self-care. But it also comes from the same kinds of things that we recommend that folks do in psychotherapy around self-care.
Oh, can you tell me a little more about that?
Yeah. So we actually have a whole chapter on self-care, and we all of the chapters have in them some kind of activity for folks to do. And so we built activities around things like, for example, in the self-care chapter, how do you use the powers of the different infinity stones to imagine what are the things that I need to do to power up and be able to use this infinity stone? And we rooted that in things like mindfulness and yoga practice. And I practice something called acceptance and commitment therapy in my clinical practice. And we used a lot of ideas from that to kind of then translate it to how can a lay audience use a mishmash of these tools, not as psychotherapy per se, but as something tangible to be able to take away and say, okay, this is how I make a self-care plan for myself. And just acknowledging that activism, while we're saying fan activism is fun, and it is fun, it's hard too, especially if you are fighting for things that are part of your own identity.
Were there fandoms that you discovered that you did not anticipate existing?
So this is Tanya. I don't know about not existing, but I think I will echo Kayla's comments on us being a great team and very complimentary. So I am less involved in sports fandom and kind of true crime. So that was an interesting area that I'll let Kayla speak to, like realizing what fans of podcasts and true crime podcasts specifically, and how they've been involved with solving cold cases and things like that. That was fascinating for me to learn about. And then I will shout out for some of the Dungeons and Dragons fandoms, like Critical Role and shows like that, that for me are just the absolute best examples of grassroots kind of homebrewed media really taking off and becoming mainstream, right? That was fascinating.
Yeah, and I think you mentioned one of the fandoms that you were both interested in personally was Our Flag Means Death, which is fairly new compared to, say, Star Wars. It's I guess, encouraging, like, for me to hear that new fandoms can be born, that it's not just all the stuff that's been around for decades and decades.
Yeah, you bet. This is Tanya. I've sort of theorized in my head this notion of a fandom life cycle, right? Where like a social movement has a life cycle. And this may have gotten cut from the book, but, you know, wait for it for me to put it in somewhere else at some point. Mm-hmm. But this notion that, you know, fandoms emerge, they coalesce, right? They kind of become more and more popular and more known. And then they might peak or sort of sustain for a while and then kind of go into what in social movements are called abeyance structures or some other iteration. And then you've got like these evergreen fandoms like Star Wars, Star Trek, and even Marvel to some extent, where you just keep getting new and new variations, different phases, et cetera. The risk for that, of course, as we're, I think, seeing with some, is fatigue, right? Or oversaturation. But yes, the newer fandoms, I think it's great to see something. I was there for Wynonna Earp as well, kind of in the beginning, and watching that get really popular, watching the fans really fight for it to get it. I think even a second season, a third season, and then a fourth final season of it, fans organizing and lobbying production companies to really advocate for that is very powerful and inspiring to see that. But we are, as I don't know if I can say a lot about this, but we are looking closely at the Our Flag Means Death fandom and how folks are really responding to that and rediscovering their love of fan works and creativity. Like just looking at the various costuming groups that we've seen online and looking at the fan art and fan works that have come about just in, I don't know how long has it been, maybe 9 months or something. And just,
yeah,
it just grows
it was
and grows.
March or April. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's been just quite a ride.
This is Kayla. You mentioned kind of reigniting fandom as well. That's a lot of what we're seeing with the Our Flag Means Death fandom. You know, a lot of folks that I've seen creating in that fandom are folks that I saw creating in other fandoms that are really excited about Our Flag Means Death because it's more positive queer representation. We're not digging for the subtext. Mm-hmm. We get the subtext and then we actually get the text.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask, like, what do you think Our Flag Means Death did right? Why did that manage to attract so much of an audience and such an enthusiastic audience?
This is Tanya. I think what they did right was representation in way that was more nuanced and not you never felt like they weren't going to follow through on things. And I think you didn't have to have one character kind of carrying the weight of all this representation. So they didn't hurt their characters. They didn't fall into some of those traps like bury your gaze or, you know, they told a compelling story that was fun with compelling characters who were at the very least more complex, I think, than you would typically see in some of these media. And they still had drama. They still had intrigue and various things happen. And so I think that plus it's just it knows it's a little bit silly. And I think audiences can appreciate that. And that inherent, you know, the kind of anachronistic playfulness that they do in that show is really, really great. And maybe we all just needed to laugh a little bit this year. I don't know. I did. That was one part of it for me, that it became a comfort, you know, a comfort show very much.
Yeah, I think I've seen in my own experience with fandoms is that they often are very queer inclusive, or at least I've benefited from being connected to fandoms that are. And it seems like Our Flag Means Death is particularly, I don't know, not just welcoming, but when the season started, when the first season started, I found myself doing what I often, you know, just have become habituated to, which is like, oh, wouldn't it be nice if this turned into a romance? Wouldn't it be nice if that person was queer and that one and that one and that one? And then, you know, not to spoil too much, but as the season progressed, I found myself being so surprised at how happy I was at what they were giving us. You know, I think it's so unusual that a show is so, I guess, generous with its representation.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree. This is Tanya. I guess I will just say too, just the diversity of different body sizes and ages and, mm-hmm. you know, national orientations. And just, I found that, you know, refreshing because the older I get, the less I can identify, you know, with the teen or the 20 something person. And just, I don't know that I ever really have, because that wasn't my experience. So watching people go through their versions of midlife crises, that as a 40 something person, just really that I really felt that on a personal level, like, oh, this show gets me.
Hmm. How do you see?
Oh, go ahead.
This is Kayla. The other thing I think is really important. You mentioned that there weren't some of these pitfalls like bury your gaze and some of the tropes that we can see in media. The other thing that was really important, I think, about Our Flag Means Death is that while there are a lot of queer relationships and queer characters, and there's a non-binary character, they also, that aspect of their identity was never the drama. It was a piece of who they were. It was an important piece of who many of the characters are, but it's never the focus of the drama.
Mm. Yeah, that's true. It's as much as those stories, as important as those are to tell, it is also nice that they could just have a story without having to process some sort of identity crisis connected to their identity. With shows like Our Flag Means Death coming out during the pandemic, have you seen pandemic, you know, the change in the way that we live affecting fandoms or affecting the works that people are interacting with or the works that are getting made?
This is Kayla. Absolutely. People, for a while, there was a whole genre of fanfic where characters were getting COVID or dealing with COVID or were set in a hospital where they were in an alternate universe where they were nurses dealing with COVID. And so I think a lot of folks, used FanWorks as a way to cope. I know I definitely used FanWorks as a way to cope and had not gotten super into fan fiction until the pandemic. And I suddenly had a lot of time on my hands. And it was a way to have a connection to this thing that I couldn't do in person anymore. I couldn't go to conventions. Conventions weren't happening. And so it was a way to stay connected and see what other people were making.
This is Tanya. And I will say too, just some of the meta fandom engagement practices were really useful. I think for folks to try and sustain some form of interaction or connection through the pandemic. So I had used Zoom before, right? And I had used other kinds of video chat, both in my personal and professional lives. And so watching a lot of folks really get into these, critical role, like hours and hours of watching people play D&D and being able to do D&D online. And so that I saw folks do that and then find community online in ways and find ways to be creative and productive that they maybe hadn't done before, or hadn't been able to focus on because they were busy with things. But being stuck at home, it just became an interesting opportunity for people to explore those various types of fan engagement, I think.
This is Kayla. I think another important piece there that you highlighted is that we had been engaging in online socialization before the whole world was engaging in online socialization. I really was very curious watching my colleagues and some of my friends have such a hard time to that adjustment to socializing online. And for me, it just felt very second nature. I have friends still to this day who I've never met in person, who I talk to regularly because I've met them through fandom. Tanya and I have only met in person a handful of times. So this was something that was very familiar to me, and I felt very connected to people throughout the pandemic. And there was this sort of resilience I was seeing that was really kind of nice that, this is something we already know how to do.
Have there been I guess franchises or properties or whatever you want to call them, fandoms, or pieces of entertainment that have been better than others about embracing the fandom? I'm thinking about how it seems like the guy whose name escapes me who wrote Our Flag Means Death. I think it's David something, right? David Jenkins.
That sounds right. Yes.
Yeah. So I've seen that. Him and much of the cast of that show has been really enthusiastic about the embrace that fans have had. How do the creators of the original work, how have you seen them respond to the fandoms that spring up around them?
This is Tanya. I wrote an article about this actually with respect to Wynonna Earp and how the showrunner, Emily Andrus, made intentional choices that were probably challenging, but did so in order to respect fans and to not recreate various kinds of, I guess I would almost say traumas that fans may experience when media is not sensitive. So I think increasingly folks are realizing this and understanding that there's a responsibility here. With great power comes great responsibility. And so I do see showrunners and creators being more thoughtful, being more directly engaged, and specifically with respect to Wynonna Earp, what had happened was a show called The 100 that I am not particularly familiar with. I know what it is, but they'd had a situation that was resoundingly criticized as a bury your gaze moment where a character had come out, had a relationship, a same-sex relationship consummated, and then was almost immediately killed, apparently. And fans were just understandably frustrated, upset. They felt like they had trusted this media, right? And so shortly after that, the season finale or one of the final episodes of the season of Wynonna Earp was airing, and a character that was in a same-sex relationship was going to be shot in the episode. And the showrunner chose to reveal that the character was wearing a bulletproof vest so that fans would not think that this was falling into that. So, I mean, talk about like being showing respect for the fandom by saying, look, I understand this is a problem. I want you to know we're not doing that. And I'm going to actually spoil a major plot point in this, mm-hmm. in this show, just to show that I hear you, I care, I know it's important. So things like that. Also Andrus and I would say Jenkins are quite playful with fans on Twitter. I think another great showrunner, I'm not sure if he's the showrunner or a writer, is it Will Graham with, oh my gosh, A League of Their Own, like the most recent. I know he's been quite engaged with the fandom on Twitter, and it's great to see that influence and that back and forth. And fans feel really validated when they feel like I can trust this person to not, you know, recreate trauma for me, right? And I can kind of invest and go all in on fighting for this show. And we really saw that with Wynonna Earp.
This is Kayla. With Supernatural, I think we also saw a lot of back and forth engagement. I saw something at one point that I think it has the most individual conventions running any given year compared to any other fandom. And the main actors are nearly always there, you know, save for some kind of illness. They've created documentaries about that fandom and how the creators and celebrities and fans all interact. There have been many books written by one of our colleagues, Lynn Zubernus, about the fandom and how the actors have been a big part of shaping what that fandom looks like. And there's also been a lot of ways that show spoke to fans as it was happening. There was a lot of fourth wall breaking. There were fan conventions embedded in the show. There was a fandom created musical in the show. So there's all these ways that the show talked back to fans. Now, unlike what Tanya was saying with Wynonna Earp, they did not always handle shipping in the best way. But one of the things that was always really fascinating to me and why I got into the ship that I mentioned earlier, Destiel, is that it was something that I got to watch evolve over time because the show had been on the air for so long. It used to be Fight Club rules. You did not talk about that at cons. It was very frowned upon. Mm-hmm. I was just at a convention recently and it was brought up in a panel to one of the actors. Not only was it handled very respectfully by the actor, but the entire room cheered and was extremely excited for that question, where that would have been absolutely, and has been in past conventions, booed. And so it was really interesting over time to see how fan engagement with that property changed the outcome of the show and the fandom.
How well represented are queer people behind the scenes of the making of these pieces of entertainment?
Not as well as we could be. Mm-hmm. I think is the best answer to that. It's getting better. There are more queer people playing themselves. There are more non-binary actors playing both non-binary and binary characters. There are more queer writers in the writing rooms, and there's still not as many as there could be. And particularly when you start to look at other intersectional identities like BIPOC identities and queer identities being represented together.
This might seem like an obvious question, but what's the importance of representation behind the scenes and in the making of entertainment? Like why does it matter so much?
How much time do you have? No, this is Tanya. It's so important. It's so important. I will speak as both a person who is studying this and as an individual. I'm from a tiny, tiny, tiny town in Wisconsin, and my first exposure to identities that were different from my own was media, right? And to see those stories told and to see folks, even in fantasy worlds, represented in ways that show that identities are not a monolith, that people are individuals, they have individual experiences. It gives you empathy and compassion for going forward into your real world life and knowing that this person may not come from the same place as you and may not even speak the same, you know, first language as you, but you have a shared humanity. You can have common ground. You can work together. You can show respect for that individual. So I think I always knew I was different, but I didn't really have the right words for that until very, very recently did I come out as non-binary. And it's because of media. It's because I saw a relationship and a character that I finally went, oh, this clicked. This something, you know, some unlocked achievement unlocked in my head. And I went, oh, this is, yeah, I am that identity. In fact, I can claim that now. And I feel confident in that and better, more authentic. So it matters, I think, for both individuals and also to give you just being a more well-rounded and you know, a better human, hopefully.
This is Kayla. I think that piece about it being well-rounded is also just so crucial because I had the vocabulary and I couldn't see myself in the terms that I now use because I wasn't seeing a lot of folks in my life or on TV or in movies that matched my experience. So, you know, I would, for example, see a bisexual character that was hypersexualized, and I identify as bi and pansexual, but I don't experience my world as hypersexualized. I actually have, through fandom, come to figure out that I identify more closely with demisexual. And so not only having representation, but having a lot of variability in that representation is so important. Similarly, I very easily identified with women characters growing up because there are parts of my identity that are feminine, and it was easy to sort of fall into those roles and say, you know, Princess Leia or Buffy, it fits, but it never quite fit the whole story. And it wasn't until I started watching Supernatural that there was this absence of women characters that I no longer had all of those social norms to hide behind, and I could actually ask myself hard questions about what is it that you're actually identifying with in male characters? Is it that you're attracted to them, or is it something else? And that something else was, oh, no, this is a part of my identity. There's a masculine side of myself that I haven't really let myself explore, that I was able to explore through that media and through fandom, that just... I don't know that I would have found that had there not been a character that I could read as queer who was also very masculine, which didn't show up in a lot of the other media I watched. And I watched a lot of really fantastic media, even media by queer people for queer people, but it often focused on more feminine identities, which are great, but not the whole picture of who I was. And so there was always that piece missing.
Have you seen examples of folks who began with fandom moving into a position where they are either in a position to create works within that fandom or create new pieces of intellectual property that people are excited to participate in?
Yeah, Tanya, did you want to take that one?
You go for it, and then I'll chime in if I have more.
Okay. This is Kayla. I think we're seeing that a lot, actually. You know, we see every time, you know, new Marvel and Star Wars movies, for example, get made, and the folks who are both acting in and creating those often talk about watching those properties growing up, and that this is their chance to play in that sandbox. It's all sort of fan fiction at this point. And so it is something that is showing up more and more.
This is Tanya. I will add that one thing I learned in the Xena fandom, which I another shout out for the Xena Warrior Princess being very engaged with their audience and respectful and knowing their audience. I don't think that show, because of when it aired and how it aired, was able to be, you know, 100% canonically confirming of the relationship between Xena and Gabrielle. But boy, they did everything they could. They really did. I mean, there's kisses, there's saying I love you, saying this person's my soulmate. I don't feel like I'm spoiling it because it's an almost 30-year-old show at this point. But the creators of this show were very aware of the fans. And once they realized they had such a large following among among women, loving women folks, they really, they broke the fourth wall. They teased about it. They catered to that, right, a bit. And back to your question, one of the folks who was a famous fan fiction writer actually was brought in to write scripts for the final season of the show and wrote official episodes, right? And we've seen this a couple of times in the Supernatural fandom, in, again, the Xena fandom, and then even in something like that many people might be not know that 50 Shades of Grey was originally a Twilight fan fiction to make it, which I don't necessarily, that's not my favorite media product, the 50 Shades, but it's interesting that a lot of folks who end up writing on these shows or producing them, you know, were fans of some nerdy media at some point, or I don't remember what I was watching and I saw a Star Trek Deep Space Nine reference. And I was like, oh my gosh, I understand that reference. And I got very excited. Right. But it was clear that the writer or the director had, you know, intentionally referenced that show. And so it all at some point goes back to some of those same stories that we've told for a long time that we find compelling. But yes, we've seen that. We've seen that increasingly, I think, in the fandoms that we've looked at.
Before we wrap up, I'd love to invite you both to show how you would invite newcomers into one of the fandoms that you love.
How we would invite newcomers. That's great. Well, I would say, you know, watch the media or engage in the media and then find a group of people to talk about it with, like look at some fan works, look at some fan art, check out what fans are doing. Like if they're fundraising, if they're doing various meetups at conventions, it's hard to overstate the role of conventions and fan communities. Finding those either online or there's Discord servers, right? There's a lot of different ways to participate in fandom and fan communities. For older folks like me, there's Facebook, right? And there's various groups like that. But you know, you name it, there's probably a fan platform you can find your group. And if that group is not quite in line with what you want to be talking about, you know, there's other groups. So if it's not quite the right fit, feel free to find a different fan community. They're out there.
This is Kayla. What I would add to that is I really encourage folks to talk openly about the things that they love, whether that is strictly fandom or just a piece of media that they love. One of the things that I've seen a lot, especially among other psychologists, is there's a lot of stigma to identifying as a member of a fandom, and there's a lot of overlap between that and the kind of stigma that folks in queer communities often feel. And so I don't want to push anyone to be visible when they don't feel like they can be. And there are so many people who I've met who I find out are also really into fandom and really love things like this and have never gone to a convention, would never say that this is something that they do to their colleagues because they're so worried about being judged. And it's one of those things where there's likely many more of us out there participating in things like this who love things like this and benefit from things like this that we could be creating communities that we just don't because we're not talking to one another about it.
So tell folks again one more time, how can folks find your book and follow along with the work that you're doing?
Yes, you can find our book. You can just search Fandom Acts of Kindness. It is published by Penguin Random House with a smaller press, but it's going to be available pretty much everywhere that you would buy books, and it's available for pre-order. And I'm Tanya Cook, and I run our Twitter account, which is at AKNerdFighting. And you can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/alwayskeepnerdfighting.
Fantastic. Well, Tanya and Kayla, thanks again so much for joining me.
Thank you. Thanks for having
us.
Thank
you.
Thanks to Kayla and Tanya for joining me, and thanks to you for listening. Their book comes out on January 3rd, 2023, and there's a link to get it in the description. And thanks to everybody who makes The Sewers of Paris possible on Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/MattBaum to support the show and get backer rewards. Check out my upcoming book, Hi Honey, I'm Homo, for a history of queer characters on American sitcoms. Visit my YouTube channel for stories from behind the scenes of iconic pop culture, and you can keep up with even more of my work through my weekly newsletter. You can find all that and more at mattbaum.com. The theme song for The Sewers of Paris is Parisian from filmmusic.io by Kevin MacLeod of Incomptech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0. And until next time, croissant.